Bob's Red Mill, believes in baking, breakfast, and the pursuit of good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Ben Leventhal, founder and CEO of Resi. We'll talk to Ben about food, wine, restaurants, tech, trends, and of course, Resi. We'll taste the California Sauvignon Blanc for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Ben Leventhal is the co-founder and CEO of Resi, a mobile app for people who love eating at great restaurants but hate hassling for reservations, and for restaurants who want a dynamic operational software platform. Ben previously was co-founder of Eater.com, a well-known national food and business blog. And another little-known fact about Ben is he's the tallest stack of tortilla champion. Is that true?
It is true.
It is true.
It is a true fact.
Welcome to the show, Ben. Good to have you on.
Good to be here.
Let's give our audience a little background on who you are and how you got to where you are. So give me a little info on your journey to how you wound up at Resi, which is where you are today.
Well, I was born and raised in New York.
Okay.
And I think it's safe to say that restaurants have been part of my life.
When you say New York City or a suburban?
Combination of New York City and Larchmont, New York.
Okay.
My parents both grew up in Brooklyn and moved out to the suburbs as an extended experiment.
Both professionals?
Both professionals. And we, as a family, moved back to the city, and I went to high school in the city, and I've been in New York City ever since.
Okay.
So we grew up a family going out to eat quite a lot. For my birthday, year after year, I got to pick three restaurants to try. So I dragged the family out for breakfast, lunch, and dinner at three new restaurants. And at that time, I was using the Zagat Guide to pick the spots. And admittedly, for certain years, it was places like Planet Hollywood.
Oh, boy.
And the Fashion Cafe, if you remember that spot. But I've always loved restaurants, and I've always felt incredibly comfortable in restaurants and energized by restaurants. And so when I graduated college, I went to school at GW in Washington, D.C. When I graduated college, I went to work at VH1, and I quickly picked up several side projects and hobbies that were in and around the restaurant business. I produced a newsletter for a couple of years that was really just a list of places to eat and drink in New York City, and I sent that out to a list of about 5,000 people, and it was just my weekly curated list.
Did it have a name?
It was called She Loves New York.
Okay.
The muse,
why she when it's he?
Well, the muse of the site was a guy I worked with at VH1, actually, and he was just exploring New York for the first time and navigating the waters of New York and the dating you know, rules of the road. And so it was, he was the muse and the site was sort of talking to him. And so the point was, she loves New York, now go and show it to her.
Okay.
And so that led to me meeting my Eater co-founder, Lockhart, and we had a real sort of similar.
But be a little more specific. I mean, what brought you two guys together? I mean, you were doing this newsletter.
Well, I was doing She Loves New York, and he was working on a blog called Below 14th Street, which was chronicling literally the physical storefronts, what was changing, what was being built, what was coming down on the Lower East Side, which was his neighborhood. And so if you think about what Eater has become, it's about neighborhoods, it's about restaurants.
Right.
The DNA of Eater is really two things. It's, one is my curated list of those places that I loved and my take on the scene, and two is that obsession with locality and with what's going on in your city. And so, you know, we had this was 2003, 2004, and this is the sort of dawn, if you will, of blogging in New York,
right,
and the sort of blog media scene and Gawker.
Do you remember any other people doing stuff then?
Oh, I mean, there's various sites. I mean, you know, I mean, some of them still exist, but, you know, Gothamist was writing about food. And,
right.
You know, there was a bunch of other stuff. There was something called the Strong Buzz, and there was something called the Food Section. And there's all these little things, but it's the dawn of blogging in New York, and Gawker is the big example, obviously. And so, you know, you've got all these different bloggers and people that are writing about New York and living in New York. And, you know, not surprisingly, it turns out that Locke and I had some friends in common and brought us together.
That's how it came together.
And that's where we started.
So that was when did it really materialize?
So that's all 2005? Sort of the backstory, 2003, 2004. And then in 2005, we launched in July after about 6 months of tinkering and playing around behind the scenes. And we launched in July, and from there, you know, it took off.
So you had a run at Eater for how long?
So I was running Eater. I was running Eater for 4 or 5 years. And loosely involved for a little bit of time thereafter, obviously it's still very close to me in terms of, you know, how much I care about
it's
it.
Your baby.
But now
us what ultimately happened. I mean,
well,
it
we sold the
to
properties
a fairly
to Vox
major
Media,
player,
yeah,
Vox
to
Media.
Vox Media at the end of 2013, and now it's in, I think, 30 cities, give or take. I know they launched London this week. It's been quite fun seeing it develop.
Were you able to monetize? Were you making money?
Yeah, it was a media company. I mean, we were able to sell it because we had, I think, you know, we had great product market fit in terms of what we were publishing, and we actually did have a sales team that was successful. So yeah.
So you, like you said, you sort of towards the end at Eater. You pulled back a little.
Well, yeah. I mean, there was various forces at play, but I left the company in about 2010. I was involved in helping the site go with a national launch and various project stuff thereafter. But I started exploring other stuff around 2010.
Right. I did a few things.
I did a couple of projects with the Food Network. I worked on a site called Kitchen Surfing, which was a marketplace for chefs. You know, it was the Uber for chefs, if you will.
Was that before its time? Or
I don't know if it was before its time. You are seeing another wave of those kinds of companies.
That's why I asked,
because
you're seeing a handful
of
major people in it.
I think that people are entrepreneurs and investors and you know, the dining public or the eating public continues to sort of be mesmerized by this idea of bringing chefs into the home.
Yeah.
You know, in a similar way.
Chefs
that
are rock stars.
Chefs
restaurants
are rock stars.
Were temples. Chefs were rock stars.
Yeah.
Now sommeliers are rock stars.
Absolutely. And in the same way that you had Uber sort of making black cars accessible to everyone, the idea of private chefs becoming accessible is sort of, you know, it's kind of a tantalizing idea. I don't know if it was before its time. We still haven't seen somebody break out and get it right.
Right.
It's a very hard thing to do. Right. You know, it's another
maybe
show.
Maybe it's not the best or right idea.
We haven't seen the right execution so far. That's for sure.
Right. So get me to Resy. You get to Resy at about 2014. You filled in the couple of years.
Yep. So at the end of 2013, Gary Vaynerchuk, whom you know, and I, having spent really the better part of a couple of years riffing on ideas, and I would say...
How did you come to meet Gary?
Well, I came to meet Gary in the early Eater days, actually.
Okay.
We had a mutual friend who was hosting wine dinners, wine tastings, blind tastings, where everybody brought a bottle, you know, the classic format. And Gary and I were at those tastings together, you know, we're fast friends.
Met and bonded.
Yeah, for sure. Which, of course, is not hard over 10 bottles of wine.
But, no. with anything.
But we met back in those days and had been friends for some time. And I think in many ways had been thinking about trying to figure out how to do a project together. And at the end of 2013, as he was starting the Vayner RSE Fund and I was looking for something of real substance to sink my teeth into, you know, we kind of coalesced around the idea of food and technology and restaurants and started talking generally about what that might look like. And, you know, we sort of gravitated towards this idea of Resi, which was to say, there's all this technology in restaurants that's garbage, and this industry is changing rapidly, and you're seeing consumer behavior change. Everybody's on their phones instead of on their desktop computers, and restaurants are struggling in myriad ways. And so there's something here. And there's really something here. And so, you know, Gary is Gary, and I love talking ideas and riffing just as much as he does. And
right.
So, you know, that's how that got started.
So we'll talk about Resi in a few minutes. I want to cover a bunch of other things. But I could tell you a story. I was at a Knick game with Gary and AJ and I think a guy named Mike Playa. And Gary leans over to me and he says, I have this great idea. Not that he was taking credit for
sure.
It. Because I have this great idea. It's this reservation service. Would you pay a couple of bucks to get into the best restaurants? He wasn't even done with the sentence. I said, I'm in. You know, I love the idea. And I think it was about a year and a half later, you know, when everything happened. So I know you guys were working on it. Let's talk about a bunch of things, and then we'll get specifically into Resi. I think you would be a great guy to tell me about current wine, food, restaurant trends. I want you to tell me what you're seeing now, what's going on out there, because you're really on the pulse of it.
Well, I think that we're seeing, in terms of the restaurant scene, I think we're seeing a couple of big things. Certainly, the business of running restaurants is getting harder, and it's getting more complicated.
Why?
More sophisticated, because the stakes are higher, and it's more expensive to open a restaurant than it ever has been. And so being successful requires a higher level of sophistication, I think.
So the business part has become more of a focus than ever.
I think it's safe to say that the business of restaurants has, in many ways, become the center of gravity in a way that food was, actually,
right,
10 years ago. And so what you're seeing as a result of that is savvy operators are playing with different kinds of models, different kinds of revenue streams. One of the reasons why takeout and delivery is becoming something that's trickling up to the highest, really, level of restaurants is because that's an opportunity for a new revenue stream for a lot
like
of restaurants.
Like David Chang.
Yeah. As they're seeing costs of doing business go up, the opportunity to get some better utilization out of the kitchen and to generate revenue against, you know, deliveries and takeouts, that's something that they need to be exploring. And you're also seeing, obviously, restaurateurs play around with a lot of different formats. So now there's still the very high end of fine dining, which is, you know, guys like Danny Meyer and Will Gadara, who are really running incredibly sophisticated and nuanced and, I would say, graceful restaurant operations. But you're also seeing a lot of other kinds of operators play with hybrid concepts. You know, you have somebody who's running a restaurant at night and a cafe during the day. And I think that those things, you're seeing that as a result.
What's an example of that?
There's a restaurant called La Pecora Bianca, which is a cafe during the day and fine dining at night. But you could also, you know, it's not a stretch to say that something like Le Pain Quotidien is a result of how dining is changing. That's, you know, this sort of, it's a restaurant, but it's a cafe, and there are waiters, and you are ordering off a menu, but it's sort of, you can tell it's something that's much more closer to sort of, you know, quick serve than it is necessarily fine dining.
Right.
So, I think that's a big headline that you're seeing in the industry right now is just the amount of experimentation and the fragmentation in terms of format that you're seeing in restaurants for sure.
Give me some food trends.
Food specific.
Yeah. I mean, you brought up two great examples. I mean, the restaurant as a business.
Yeah. I think in terms of food trends, obviously local and sort of farm fresh is continuing to be something that people are very focused on. You're seeing now hydroponic and other kinds of farms that are actually bringing, you know, for example, you can grow lettuce. There's a company called Bowery, I think it's called Bowery Farms, and they're doing all hydroponic farming in a building in New York City.
Right.
So, you know, farming is changing, and that's impacting restaurants because now suddenly you can say you have local lettuce, and it wasn't grown in soil, but it is local in the same way. So, that's
local farm to table is even becoming more micro, like Rosemary's on the Roof or the Brooklyn Farms on the Roof.
It's definitely becoming more micro. It's just becoming more. Well, I wouldn't be pessimistic about it. I think that farming is getting more efficient. That's certainly something you're seeing. It's sort of obviously a parallel industry. It's not exactly what we're talking about, but all restaurants now, you know, the price of entry on ingredients, I think it's safe to say, in the real true dining category, you got to have local stuff. You got to have a perspective on sourcing. And that's really something that has moved from, you could call it a trend 5 years ago, now to sort of just a way of doing business. I think that's a big one.
Well, you take a place like Stonehill, you know.
Blue Hill at Stone Barns
or Blue Hill, you know, and they've been doing it forever. Are places trying to do it and they're just kind of flubbing it? It's like calling potato chips natural because there's no additives.
I think restaurants are making a real concerted effort. I mean,
it's all good.
Yeah, I think it's all good, and I think that we'll continue to see how it evolves. But I think that the focus on it is what's important, and what is encouraging is that just sourcing and ingredients. You know, again, it's now just how restaurants
right.
operate. There is just no, you can't run a sophisticated restaurant and expect to be taken seriously unless you're taking your sourcing seriously as well.
Right. People expect it, demand to look for it.
Yeah.
How important is wine to a restaurant?
Well, actually, I think that what we're seeing now is actually a return to wine as a focus in restaurants. I think you definitely are seeing...
Return? When did it fall off in your calculation or mind?
I don't know if it fell off, but what I'm saying is... I'm noticing that there is now a real connection being made between wine service and what the restaurant is marketing as their atmosphere, as their sell. So I would give you two examples. In New York, there's Pasquale Jones, which is one of my favorite restaurants, and I'll probably mention it again if you ask me about, you know, my favorite places. But they're running a very, very sophisticated wine program.
Well, the guy, you know, Robert quite well, is one of the great
he's
wine
one of
people
the greats.
In New York.
And they're putting it against pizza,
right?
And so that kind of match is
and
really...
And not a huge list and not an expensive list.
Not a huge list, but a very well-curated list. And so that's the sell of that restaurant. In L.A., you've got a place called John and Vinny's, which is coincidentally also a pizzeria. And what are they doing in the back? They have a wine store in the back of the restaurant. And so I do think that you are seeing now, and maybe the point is that you're coming down market a little and it's now becoming... front and center at more casual restaurants, but I think that wine as a marketing and selling point in the restaurant is definitely something that's in vogue right now.
Well, I was going to ask you, can you give me a fine wine establishment where wine is not part of the overall success? The answer is there really isn't, but you've also said that, not that Pasquale Jones or John and Vinny's is downscale, but it's not, you know, the classic fancy restaurant. The food's incredible, but the wine program is, you know, a high priority.
And there. I think if you think about a restaurant from a previous generation that was known for its wine, you would go to a place like Veritas, right?
It's purely a wine place.
And that's a white tablecloth restaurant, and that's, you know, a restaurant that aspires to Michelin stars and 4 stars, 3 stars, New York Times. Very expensive, and that, you know, is the old idea of a wine restaurant. The new idea of a wine restaurant is John and Vinny's or Pasquale Jones.
Right. Or even Charlie Bird.
Exactly.
Places like that. Do you have any idea, I don't know if you'd know this, you don't have to, I mean, a good restaurant, how important is wine percentage-wise?
too. Oh, I think it varies widely. I mean, I think,
take a place like a Pasquale Jones or something like that. There's a lot of effort towards the wine.
I think that you're seeing those places. I mean, obviously the margins are quite good. I think you're looking at, 30 to 50% of revenue from wine.
From wine.
Yeah.
So that's how
maybe
important.
More, yeah.
Yeah, because the markups are great. I'm curious your take on millennials. What impact are millennials making, and how are they, and how are they changing the restaurant business? Is that a feel? I mean, are people feeling that? Is that a wave?
I think that probably the thing that I would gravitate to in terms of millennial impact is if you think about how millennials are interacting with the world and where they're making discoveries, where they're making restaurant choices, I think that they're part of a trend of sort of what I would call like the splintering of demand for restaurants. And so,
what does that mean?
It means that millennials, as their sort of default, are scanning Instagram, and that's where they discover restaurants, and that's where they make restaurant choices. And our Snapchat, for example.
So discovery is heavily through social media.
Yeah, but that's an important point, because if you think about where we were starting, I used Zagat.
Right.
And there's a generation.
You'd probably stare at it when you were, a kid for your birthday for hours.
For hours.
Right.
I marked it up. Right. I had a whole key for different. I have been here. I want to try this.
That's funny.
That's not how the millennial generation is discovering restaurants and making choices. So I think that's a big thing, and I think you're going to continue to see that.
So that's one aspect.
Yeah.
What about cost? Are they cheap? Are they cheaper? Are they looking for an experience that's not that much money because it's not that important?
I think you're definitely seeing in the data, you're seeing millennials are perhaps spending less on restaurants, or at least de-emphasizing, the sort of very high price, high ticket meal. I think that some of that is still to be sort of. I don't think we entirely know for sure,
right.
What the impact is going to be in terms of spending behavior. Arguably they're spending more time in social places like restaurants, and so there may be a lower average check, but there's more of them dining out. I think that there's still. Certainly, I can't speak with any authority,
right.
on that one.
I think millennials are very hip and keyed into wine, but I don't think they're interested in expensive wines, trophy wines. They're probably more interested in natural wines, interesting wines, where, again, a Pasquale Jones, a Estella, has some great choices.
Well, certainly, I think they're interested in a different way of describing and talking about wines. I mean, I think, you're seeing a guy like our friend Gary has definitely ushered in a new language and a new vocabulary around wines. And certainly some of these places like Pasquale Jones are not even categorizing wines in the same way that
you were
a decade ago. It's now about, there's now adjectives like bright and floral to describe categories, whereas 10, 20 years ago, you were talking, strictly on varietals and regions.
Right.
And
that
producers.
Definitely has changed. Blue Hill does it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
Compared to other restaurants. All right, let's shift gears a little. Let's talk about Resi specifically, which is deeply entrenched in the restaurant world. Tell me first how Resi came about. You and Gary talked
Resi
about the idea, but take it from there.
Well, as the more I talk about Resi and the longer we go out this, the more it's clear that I need to come up with a good sort of,
elevator
story of how we all started. But Resi is a result of what Gary and I saw and what our third co-founder, Mike Montero, the three of us saw as happening in the restaurant business, which is that this technology around restaurants did not and still does not reflect how restaurants have changed. And it doesn't reflect how consumers and restaurants relate to each other and communicate with each other.
So simplistically explain that.
Well, the technology simply doesn't exist to create relationships between customers and restaurants the way it should. And here's the simplest, easiest example. When Resi started, if you wanted to confirm a reservation, that was a phone call. Today, at any Resi restaurant, you confirm your reservation via text message. That's a simple shift, right? But that's the point.
It's a simple shift, period, or comma. It's also a millennial shift.
It's a behavioral shift that reflects the fact that instead of a desktop, it's a mobile device.
Right.
And
which is where most people are when they're ready to say they're late or cancel.
Right.
Mobile.
And so that's a very simple example, but it's a potent one about how and why Resi came to be, because that the void in the market in terms of technology that makes it easier for restaurants to do business, that makes it easier for restaurants and consumers to connect, didn't exist.
So let me ask you an obvious question. OpenTable's been around longer than Resi, you know, bigger platform as far as users. That option didn't exist?
Doesn't exist today.
Doesn't exist today. Okay. So the technology, proprietary, whatever, makes it easier. So that's a good
thing. And I would say even more, you know, even more to the point, the relationship that Resi has with restaurants and the relationship that OpenTable has with their restaurants is polar opposites. Resi engages with our restaurants and really pulls them into the product development process. And the reason we have certain features is because the restaurant industry has said, we want this.
That was my question. I mean, you focus on the restaurant side as much as the consumer.
Yep.
You know, good restaurants lead to good customers.
We're technology focused. We're supply side focused. We believe that good restaurants, you know, attract good consumers. And that's
so instead of just bookings and the customer. I mean, Danny Meyer always said, if I make my employees happy, they'll go on the floor happy and the customer experience will be amazing. So it was employee before customer, but the customer got the treatment. If you take care of the restaurant,
you got it.
You feel that. All right, you said that there's been as much innovation in tech as food on the plate.
Yeah.
That stuff is being translated.
Well, now there is. You know, I mean, that's the exciting part of what we're doing now. I mean, now you're sort of seeing, you know, there's lots and lots of startups that have all kinds of ideas for technology around hospitality and restaurants. Most of it won't work, but there will be products that survive and then thrive. And
why won't most of it work? Because, good idea, but yeah, not a greatly executable idea.
It's a technology, you know. I mean, we throw things on the wall and we see what sticks.
Right.
And so, you know, the things that won't work. I've talked about this with a lot of our restaurants. The stuff that won't work is the stuff that probably is too jarring for the restaurant in terms of a shift in operations, or it's something that's too hard for consumers to understand,
right,
or it's something that consumers just don't want. You know, we saw a wave of mobile payments companies come through the restaurant business, you know, probably starting in around 2008, 2009, and there was a bunch of them. A
couple of them shook out. I mean, a couple hung on.
Well, not really. I mean, you still don't have mobile payments as, you know, as a core part of the restaurant. And the reason is because all of these products had a great idea and there was a light bulb moment there around what mobile payments could be in restaurants, which is that, well, if this thing works, then you don't have to pay the bill anymore. You could just get up and walk away from the table, and that could be magical. But what didn't happen was we didn't figure out the operations. And there was too much training involved when those products came to market. And because there was all that training, and because the technology wasn't well connected to the point of sale system, that magic didn't exist. And so that's a long way of answering your question. But the point is, for technology to work in the hospitality setting, you got to have a product market fit, and that means and that means it's got to make sense. It's got to work easily. It can't be too much of a shift from what's happening today.
Otherwise, you'll lose.
Otherwise, it's not going to work.
Back up. I'm curious. When you and Gary were talking about the idea of Resi, was Michael part of the mix, or you had the idea and then you sought out the technology? Did you have a technology idea, or you had the idea and you said, now we got to create some technology?
Well,
I'm just curious of the
genesis
of that.
No, from the second that we got serious about it being a technology company.
You brought Michael in.
You know, what Gary and I may be confident and may be bold, but we're not idiots.
Right.
We're not going to build
or programmers or tech guys.
We're not going to build a technology company without somebody who knows how to build technology.
Right. So that went into overdrive pretty quickly.
And it was important to us to get a technology person involved, not only because we needed somebody to build it, but we wanted somebody with a technology background and a technology perspective to start talking about these ideas with us,
right,
and to agree or disagree with us about how viable any of this was. So and how compelling it might be
give
or not.
Me, the company's been around about 4 years, a little less.
3 years and change, yeah.
Three and change. So give me the technology evolution and growing pains. Obviously, you know a lot more today than you did now. There were probably things then that were solid then as now.
Yeah.
But what were the biggest changes or growth positive things?
Well, I think that, the biggest and the obvious thing is that we started with a very specific marketing product for restaurants, which was a way to market premium inventory. And that's now been
what we really saw, access to hard to get reservations for a small fee.
Yeah, look, what we saw sticking out like a sore thumb was that you have an excess of demand by a factor of 10 at the best restaurants at prime time. And when the bill drops, it's the same price as it is on a Monday night and a Saturday night.
Or at 5:30 or at 8.
5:30 or at 10:30 or an 8 o'clock. And before I say anything else, I think what's interesting is that we're largely not much farther along today than we were in terms of that dynamic. But that's what we saw. And so we said, there must be a way to market premium inventory in a way that benefits everyone. And so that was really where we started, which we said quite simply and straightforwardly, if you want to make a last-minute reservation at a Charlie Bird and you want to make that reservation at 7:30, you're going to have to pay a price for it. In the same way that when you book an airline ticket and you book it at the last minute, it's more expensive than if you booked it 6 months in advance.
And typically some people embraced it and some people thought
it was definitely a polarizing idea, but we're okay with that. And we were excited by the fact that it really struck a nerve with people and people understood it. I think the best news was whether you loved it or you hated it, you definitely understood what we were doing,
right,
which is really important as you're building something. But what we've done now, the company's evolved a tremendous amount, and now Resy is a full-fledged software company, and the opportunity to market premium reservations is part of a much, much broader system of tools and features that allow restaurants to run their business. And so now we run software at restaurants like La Bernardine and Pasquale Jones, and that is software that is being run in lieu of pen and paper or in lieu of an open table or something like that.
More sophisticated than an open table.
Correct.
Or any pre-existing system.
Correct.
So let's talk about some statistics for a second. So Resy has what, about 1 million+ registered users?
About 1.5 million.
All right. That's not a proprietary secret number, is it?
I gave you the scoop.
Okay. You deal with four figures in restaurants, over 1,000 different restaurants?
Yeah, we have more than 1,000 restaurants on the platform. We do more than 500,000 covers a week across those restaurants. We're in 80, more than 80 markets around the U.S.
80 markets. The reservation service is in how many markets?
In 80 markets.
What about the consumer reservation?
Well, with some of the app updates we've made recently, you can now open the app and make a reservation at any of our restaurants anywhere in the country.
Okay.
We make a concerted marketing effort in about 20 cities like Los Angeles and New York and San Francisco and New Orleans and Boston and places like that.
There's a thing restaurants love about Resy, because the Resy user is a committed user and there's a low no-show rate.
Lowest in the business.
Tell people what a low no-show rate is, about what is it, and why it's important to a restaurant.
So our no-show rate is about 4% globally. That's across 500,000 covers a week. 4% of those are no-shows.
So that means however many reservations are made, 4% of the people back out.
Yeah, and
even with the texting thing that they're not going to use, those bastards.
To put that in context, most of the other services that are out there run about a 15%
no-show. So 3-4 times.
Yeah, quite a lot more, and that's the result of how we relate to our consumers. I think, we believe fundamentally that consumers don't have any particular motivation to no-show. But we give them the tools to make sure that if they're not coming, they communicate that to the restaurant.
Right. And you talked about it earlier when the company started having access to reservations for a fee. You got away from shoulder reservations. When people go on open table or they call the restaurant, sometimes they get the 5:30 or the 10:30 reservation.
Sure.
Resi kind of cut through that and made it accessible for fees. I mean, that's still important?
Well, some restaurants are using the fees. I think that the broader strategy development is that restaurants are using the software to connect with more customers and to create more relationships with more customers.
So analytics are massively important.
The analytics are important. Just the ability to know.
That was part of the evolution we talked about before. The shoulder reservation thing is part of it. But
the ability to know who's coming through the door really matters quite a lot.
Right. Danny Meyer probably almost invented that. I mean, a guy would come in from St. Louis to Union Square Cafe, love sherry. He would hand it to the guy. Now you can put all that on.
You can do a lot of that with technology.
So let's talk about Danny Meyer for a couple of minutes. So Danny Meyer, who owns Union Square Hospitality, who has some of the great restaurants in New York, Gramercy Tavern, Union Square Cafe, he's doing something interesting with wine and Resi technology and Apple and the Apple Watch. Tell me what's going on with that. It sounds kind of fun.
Well, Danny...
Or tell me what you can tell me.
Oh, I can tell you probably most of it. Danny and his team approached us more than a year ago and started talking to us about Union Square Cafe, the new Union Square Cafe, and various things that they wanted to accomplish with the restaurant, including making it easier for SOMs to do their jobs. And there's a particular physicality to Union Square Cafe, the new Union Square Cafe, which is that the wine cellar is a couple of flights removed from the main floor of the dining room. And so there really is...
Above or below?
Below. Below. And so there is a lot of back and forth that the SOMs are doing, a lot of flights of stairs climbed. And so one of the things that we worked with them to solve was... streamlining the wine ordering process and communicating it to the SOMs in a way where we could reduce the number of trips back and forth. And so what we did was fairly straightforward. In the end, we developed a product for the Apple Watch, and all the SOMs wear Apple Watches. And any time a wine is ordered in the dining room, they get an alert on the watch. And so that means if you're on your way down to the cellar for
grab
one
bottle,
you can grab two or three bottles because those two or three wine orders have come in and they're on your wrist.
Pretty smart.
And so that's something that we worked on with his team and is being used.
Is it on the floor right now?
Or it's on the floor live, yeah.
And how is it working out?
I think it's been a great streamlining of their operation.
It's a very cool idea in a very busy restaurant with a lot of choices and all that. All right, let me ask you one more thing and then we're going to take a break. I'm going to subject you to our wine list. We'll taste a little wine, and then I'll send you home. Tell me how you get the penetration and sign on new markets and restaurants. I mean, are you on reputation now? Is it still a sales pitch?
Yeah, I think two main channels. One is obviously the restaurants that we work with. We're very proud of our partners, and they're the best restaurants in the country. And so those kinds of restaurants attract other great restaurants. And so we have lots of restaurants coming in that way.
You're hitting some critical mass now.
We're definitely.
Let's brag a little. You signed on Le Bernardin, which is arguably one of the finest restaurants in the country.
Last week we welcomed Le Bernardin onto the platform. We are bringing on Augustine and some of those restaurants now.
So you get that guy. Hey, when you sign Le Bernardin, then come back and call me.
Yeah, guess what we're doing now.
Yeah, right. So that's good. So it's really just a sales effort, but it gets easier with that.
Right.
On the software side, too?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, of course, we also have a sales team. It's a SaaS company, and so if you're selling software as a service...
What does that mean?
SaaS, software as a service.
Okay.
If you're selling software, you got to have somebody to sell it.
Right. All right. Ben, we're going to take a break. We're talking to Ben Leventhal. Ben is the CEO of Resi. We've been talking about Resi in the New York wine scene. When we come back, we're going to subject Ben to our wine list, and we're going to make him drink a little wine. You're listening to The Grape Nation. We'll be right back.
The soil seeds were sowing. Bob's Red Mill is a proud sponsor of Heritage Radio Network and a big supporter of organic farmers. Ray and Tom Williams are two farmers who have worked with Bob for years and co-own an organic farm in eastern Oregon and Washington. Ray shares what their relationship with Bob's Red Mill means to them.
We thought that for over the long term, we thought it would make sense, better sense for the soil. Also, we thought that it was something that would improve the quality of the food supply. We're lucky in that we're working with Bob's Red Mill. We're part of a regional food network. With Bob is a fundamental relationship and cornerstone to that. We also work with other best-of-class people in the Northwest, and we're thankful for the long-term relationship that's brought good things to the soil and good things to our long-term farm economic plans. We appreciate his attitude toward absolutely high standard for the benefit of his customers. We take pride in meeting those standards.
Learn more about Bob's Red Mill and their commitment to good food for all at bobsredmill.com/podcast. Just feed our
children both and minds. All right, we're back. We're back with my guest, Ben Leventhal. Ben Leventhal is the founder of Eater.com, and now he is the CEO and one of the founders of Resi.com. We're going to subject Ben now to our wine list, and we're going to do a special wine and restaurant edition. All right, so Ben, question one.
Hit me.
At home, you and your wife, you're at restaurants, you eat out a lot. What are you drinking now? What are you kind of gravitating towards? Is it seasonal whites because it's summer? Are you trying anything?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely whites and rosés and... you know, we like the white burgundies, so we're over there a lot. And
Mr. Fancy Pants.
Yeah, you know, I
white burgundy. Don't we all like
the question?
That?
I mean, I'm just.
Hey, I wouldn't expect less from you. Come on.
I know. I mean, you know, I go through phases of generally in my life, sort of like trying lots of new restaurants or going with classic restaurants, and I'm in a phase of where I'm only going to the restaurants that I love, and so I think it's probably to some extent. Also sort of trickling back to the wines, and I'm just going with the classics.
So we talked about a few restaurants. When you go into a wine-centric restaurant like a Charlie Bird or something like that, are you experimental and you say to the somm, because you know there's good people there, I want to try something new, different, or do you usually have an idea of what you want to drink?
No, I always ask the somm at a place like that because I assume... rightfully, that they're going to have some sort of things, some zigs and zags that are not obvious, that are the right move, and they may have something open that night, or what, or you know, they may have just gotten something in and it's not on the list. And so I always solicit the advice of the somm, and I often just sort of hand the list back to them and say,
right,
you do your thing. And I'll also ask at a restaurant with a deep list. You know, I'll ask the somm, what's your favorite region? Where is this list most
they
exciting
love when
you for
do you? That.
And sort of dig in that way as well, because that's a really easy and sort of foolproof way of figuring out where, you know, where the list is the most interesting and the deepest is where the somm has gotten excited.
They curate, you know, a lot of somms lean towards a certain region, the Loire Valley, they
precisely.
Like Australia. So you're in good hands when you let them do that. All right, what about Ben Leventhal's favorite wine and food pairing? I know it's not something you think about a lot, but you're sitting down, you're having wine, you're eating something. What goes well together that's memorable to you?
Well, I mean, I
tell me champagne and oysters. I'll throw you the F out of here.
I'll go with the second most obvious, which is just like great steak and, you know, like a
cab.
Like a cab, you
burgundy.
Know, a burgundy, something like that.
That's always, I'll take that.
Yeah, sorry.
Right. No, that's good. But and I'm going to give you amnesty for the next 30 seconds. Were you going to say champagne and
no.
oysters?
No, okay. I'm not a champagne.
I believe
I'm
you.
I'm not a champagne. My wife loves champagne, but I gravitate more to the burgundy.
Okay. All right. So this is not a setup question. I ask it to everyone. Your favorite wine restaurant and or bar? And the question is based on restaurants that have great wine selection and service and all of that. And I'm not asking you to pick favorites or make enemies, but who's doing it well out there? And we may have mentioned some, but give me a few more.
Well, I mean, certainly Pasquale Jones comes to my mind first, and I know we have mentioned it, but I think that they just do a great job of mixing sophistication with a casual right. vibe.
Knowledge.
Yeah, diversity. For sure. You know, obviously, what Will and Daniel are doing at Nomad and EMP,
Thomas.
The depth of the right. Thank you. What Thomas is doing, the depth of that list is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
You know, Danny's places have not lots of depth as well.
Right. Each wine guy at each place is a killer. Whether it's Michael Engelman or Justin at Gramercy.
Yeah,
I mean,
for
those
sure.
guys know their stuff. So all of those. Do you have a favorite all-time wine? Do you have a wine that continues to resonate, like you got laid from a wine or the wine you had at your wedding or gift or birthday?
What I would say is the wine experience that is most memorable to me, and you're going to call me fancy again, but...
But you're a fancy guy.
But I had an opportunity to do a sort of a DRC Latache side by side, a bunch of different vintages, and that was incredibly memorable. And
all right, so without revealing too much, when, how long ago, where, not specific, was it a restaurant, somebody's house?
It was a private setting. It was somebody's house.
Collector.
It was a group of collectors all bringing stuff to the table to celebrate something, and I was lucky enough to be tagging along, and it turned into really quite an epic tasting.
So DRC, for our listeners, is Domaine Romani Conti. It's a Burgundy. It's probably considered, you know, the greatest, most sought-after wine in the world. So you drank multiple wines, vintages?
Yeah, all the way back to the 60s.
Wow. Now, be honest with me here. How much DRC were you drinking previous to this?
A couple of sips here and there. I'm not sure that I had a glass.
That
to
was
myself.
The mother load that day. And
maybe all. Once or twice I had a glass to myself.
Now, here's a fair question. You know about the wine. You know about the people. Was the wine amazing, or was it the whole mystique of, you know, all these cool wine guys, DRC, this is going to be incredible. You didn't even taste it. You willed it. I mean, or was it something that was really... Because that's a big wine thing, the sensory...
I would say that's almost impossible for me to answer because...
Okay.
No, because wine is... Come on, Sam. Wine is so much about the environment in
which
you drink
it. Very much so. It's been studied to be true.
And so...
Part of it.
I think objectively... Those wines, the sort of the depth of them, the layers of flavor, the way that the sort of
you picked
wine,
up on all of that,
the way the wine evolves on your palate. I mean, there's something that's sort of objectively quite something there. But also, of course, the experience.
So when you peel
always,
all that other stuff away, the wine was still pretty slamming amazing.
Look, I'll tell you, I'll give you this. As you know. When you open these wines that have been in storage for quite a long time, some of the bottles, you know, you open 10, one of them's corked.
Shot.
One of them's shot.
It's one
know?
In 10 a lot of times.
And so we opened one of those, and the subtlety of how it had been ruined was such that really I tasted it and I said, wow, this is another great wine. The Somme's... What you saw happening, this is about a group of about 10 people, half Somme's, half non-Somme's. And so what you saw happening was the Somme's started to sort of whisper. And the Somme's obviously tasted something that was off. But, you know, to my palate, right. which you know, is a layman's palate, it was a great wine. And probably objectively, it could have been passed for a great wine right. in a restaurant to most people.
But those guys
but
are
those
so
guys,
trained in
you know,
all that.
Those guys know.
All right, I usually ask my guests, because, you know, a lot of the guests are heavily in the wine business, to recommend best wine around $15, red and white. So the question to you is, if you were going out Friday night to a friend's house for dinner and you wanted to spend $15 to $20 for wine, what would you grab and bring them?
So I would say one of the bottles that I have in my refrigerator or in my closet... that I sort of buy by the case is the Baby Baby Sasakaya, which is a Le Défaussé, which is the lowest end Sassicaia.
It's a good one.
A Cabernet Sauvignon Blend.
D-I-F-F-E-U-S-E.
I think D-I-F-E-S-E.
Is it?
I think so.
Yeah,
I,
you're right. You're right. My bad.
Yeah. And that's a wine that sells for, I think, $18, $22 bucks.
One of the great winemakers.
From one of the great winemakers. I've got it in a bunch of different vintages. It's all good. It's all consistent. I think it sort of tastes a lot more expensive than it is.
Yeah.
So that's the challenge, to find
wine in that range that tastes above its price.
So that's one for me. I also like Ludit, the wines that are being made. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that exactly right.
L-I-U-D-I-T?
Yeah.
They make very good value price wines out of the West Coast.
Yeah, exactly. Those are good wines. Are you impressed?
Yes. I know you did your homework, and I'm impressed that you did your homework, but that's a terrific choice. Because that's a high-quality value wine.
And they're making a diversity of varieties. Yeah, and they're making wine on the West Coast in a Loire Valley style.
Right.
To me, their rosé, it's a little bit more expensive than your $20 price point. I think it's closer to $30.
Right. But that rosé
is really crisp and clean, and that's kind of the rosé that I'm drinking if I have the choice.
Good choice, because there's so many rosés that are in so many different styles, Italian, French, provincial, and all that. All right, last question. You did a yeoman's job here. What do you think, and I don't think we answered this, what's the next big tech thing in restaurants? Either you're working on it, you're hoping to get there, you think it's going to happen. What is it?
I think two things. One is there's just going to be more good tech in restaurants. I think that's a big point to be made.
So continued evolution of tech.
Continued evolution. It's going to get cheaper, and it's going to get better, and it's going to get more agile for the restaurant. Two is...
More penetration.
Two is I think in the next 5 years, you're going to see the end of cash in restaurants.
Really?
I think it's going to be all...
Are you saying...
Mobile payments and cards.
Okay, so cards stay there.
Yeah,
cash will go away. They'll up the game on mobile payments.
I believe so.
Okay, I believe you're probably right. All right, so that's Ben's answers on the wine list. We'll post them on our website and on our Facebook page. All right, Ben, we're going to wrap up the show with our last segment. It's called the Weekly Wine Sip. It's when we get to taste a little wine on the air.
I mean, that's why I'm here. You said we were going to be drinking wine.
Well, I gave you a little wine when you came in, and now we have some now. So every week we taste different wine on air. For our Weekly Wine Sip this week, we're tasting an interesting wine, a 2013 Sinegal, S-I-N-E-G-A-L, Napa Valley Sauvignon Blanc. So 2013, it's got a little bottle age. A lot of times when you buy Sauvignon Blanc, you're buying a 15, a 16. It's a relatively new winery in California. It opened in 2013, and it's owned by a guy named James Sinegal. And what was interesting to me is James Sinegal was the co-founder of Costco.
Really?
So he had a little money and said, hey, I'll go buy a winery. So him and his son are running the winery. And kudos to Costco in the sense that it's probably the best big box wine cellar in the country. They curate wines for a big pass-through place like this. The wine's a bit pricey, so it's not the wine you'd bring to your friend's house. It retails for about $45, which is typical for a Napa Sauvignon Blanc that a rich guy paid a lot of money for property and is making wine and all that. It's available by the Sinegal mailing list and at Better Wine Cellars. So, Jack, my friend, will you take that bottle, pour me a little, and will you give Ben a little and pour yourself some? So Sauvignon Blanc, very famous from New Zealand, has certain qualities. So, Ben, I want you to put your wine tasting hat on. So let's look at the color first. Pale yellow, typical Sauvignon Blanc, right? Let's give it a smell. Sniffy sniff, as Gary would say. So it's got a little of that citrusy, a little grassy, not too grassy. What do you pick up?
Yeah, I'm getting a little of that, right? A little citrus, a little orange, maybe?
Almost. This is a...
Lemon orange?
Yeah. This is an adjective that you get with Sauvignon Blancs, almost like a little cat pee, that sharpness.
Mm-hmm. I got that.
Okay. All right, so let's throw it over the tongue and let's see what we get here. All right, so I'll go first. Sauvignon Blancs tend to be very grassy, very limey. This is not that grassy. It's restrained that way. It definitely has some citrus and wine, but not overpowering. When you get that little tingle on your tongue, that's acidity. It's got a little acidity, which is great for food. Now, what are you picking up? You picking up any fruit, mineral?
I'm getting some minerality, I think. I think that I'm getting something earthy.
Psalms hate that term, but I know what you mean.
Something earthy.
Stony.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Any fruit? Little tropical fruit or not?
Maybe. Not a ton.
Okay. So here's what I'm getting. There's actually, I don't know if this is leftover from the glass or sediment.
Is it maybe a little grapefruit?
Definitely grapefruit. Definitely a characteristic of Sauvignon Blancs. Little honey, not sweet, maybe like a dried honey. And it's got good acidity. It's not a flat, flabby wine. So it's typically California in the sense that it doesn't have those characteristics and all that. Do you like this wine?
I wouldn't be drinking too much of this wine, I don't think.
And certainly at the price, you wouldn't do that. I think it's a well-made wine. People have certain likes about Sauvignon Blanc. This may not fit the category. Where are you as a Sauvignon Blanc drinker?
I like Sauvignon Blanc, okay. But I seek out something a little bit, I think the word I would use is a little bit milder.
Yeah.
This to me is something that would get cloying by the end of the first glass, and I like
hard to drink all
I
night.
I like a wine
Sauvignon Blanc. You can go all night.
Yeah, I like a wine that you know you can get two and a half glasses, three in.
I would agree with you. I think it's a good wine. It's a well made wine. It's a style of wine that you have to like. Not necessarily my style. I could drink it. Definitely not Ben's style. So that's the 2013 Sauvignon Blanc from Senegal. All right, worth a try. All right, we're going to wrap up the show, Ben. If you have a question, wine happening, or event, hit me up at The Grape Nation. Hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. We'll answer any questions you have. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. We'll post Ben's wine list answers, if I can make out what the hell they were. And we'll post the weekly wine sip selection on Facebook. And follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby and on Twitter at BenRuby. And we just launched a new webpage, www.thegrapenation.com. You'll see a picture of a very handsome Ben Leventhal. You'll see his wine list answers. You'll get a little background on him and all our other guests. Chock full of show and guest info. Ben, where can we find info about you on social media and even more importantly about Resy?
Resy is at Resy, R-E-S-Y, across all social media. So that's Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, just at Resy.
So I know nothing about Resy. I can go on, get a free app,
yeah.
Sign on.
Resy.com is our website, of course,
okay.
and you can certainly find all the download info there.
Okay.
As well. Search it in the App Store, R-E-S-Y.
It'll direct you through sign-ups, yep. And all of that stuff. There's no fee to sign up.
Free to sign up.
It'll tell you you can put a credit card in so you can prepay and all of that stuff, and you're off and running with that. And if people want to follow what Ben's doing, at Ben Leventhal.
Yes, sir.
Instagram and Twitter. All right. I want to thank my guest, Ben Leventhal from Resy. I want to thank our engineer, David, in the bullpen tonight. And don't forget, we're in the midst of our summer fundraising drive. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate. I know Ben's not going to like this idea, but maybe skip a meal out this month. Take that money and just donate it to heritageradionetwork.org.
We love
/donate. We're big supporters of food, restaurants, and wine. So, Ben, again, thank you for coming in. I'm Sam BenRuby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.